So today I'm joined with, well, I'll start that again.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another amazing episode of Somewhere in Between, the AIT podcast brought to you by the Royal College of GPs. I'm Anthony, and I'm back with Hatim, Mira, and Johannes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
For this week's episode, we are talking about what it's like to be a defence trainee, something that I don't really know very much about, or didn't until listening to today's interview, which is with Sean Vanstone, who's an ST1 GP trainee and a defence trainee in the Navy. And Mira and Johannes got to speak to him this week, or just Mira? Yes, just Mira. We're hearing from Johannes as well. So we're going to go into that interview in a bit. I think I didn't know much about being a defence trainee, so it was really great to hear the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I really didn't know anything about it and didn't really know what to expect when I was chatting with Sean. But as you can see, I had a million and one questions, but I did let him get more than one word in edgeways, as you'll hear later on. But it was really fascinating to hear. I think the fact is, we've talked about this before, lots of people enter into general practice after doing lots of other training before, or maybe not even having done medicine originally and done other degrees. But this was a really interesting, fascinating thing to hear about. But you don't need to really hear much from me about this. Johannes, you've got a bit more of a defence background than any of us, right?
Yeah, I had a bit of a funny anecdote with this interview with Sean, just because I met Sean last year at one of our conferences, and we just got chatting about his defence work. I was previously in the Navy myself, and it turned out that we'd actually served on the same ship, which is HMS Protector, and both been down to Antarctica. So it was a bit of a strange situation to meet someone who'd done the same kind of quite unique thing. And he'd done it as a part of his medical defense training, and I'd just done it as a warfare officer before I came into medicine. But I think it kind of shows that the military and medicine are both quite small communities. And it's quite nice, I guess, to have an overlap in those two things, because there's a lot of support in those small communities, and I think to understand a little bit more about how that defence community looks after you and how it plays into your medical career is really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely, and I also think it was a fresh take on how someone can enter the world of GP with a completely different interest. We've obviously had different episodes on, you know, trainees with interest in digital tech, talking about, you know, people who are interested in remote consulting, video consulting. We've got future episodes on leadership and things like that. But this was a fresh spin on things. I mean, and was there, have you, you said you've not really come across defense trainees before, listening to this interview and speaking to Sean before, right?
Yeah, I mean, I've like met defence trainees as like AIT reps over the years, but obviously we're kind of all spread around the country. I've never, you know, like known personally particularly any defence trainees, so it was just really interesting to hear a different perspective. I think something that it kind of definitely made me reflect on is the other skills that people bring into general practice if they've had all like these and other similar different experiences. And I think, you know, particularly when we think about any armed forces, often in the past when we've done like bits of leadership work as an AIT community, that's an area that they've really been able to contribute to, because there's so much of an emphasis on those kind of skills that in general practice might be seen as like softer skills around like management or leadership, but actually they're really important and have a massive role to play in kind of effective delivery of healthcare services as well. So so I think again it just shows how interesting it is to bring so many people with different perspectives together in the world of GP training, and so yeah, it was really interesting to listen to Sean's kind of experiences as well.
And just to touch on that, sorry Johannes, is that it was quite interesting, especially with the recent COVID-19 times that we're having, in terms of the Nightingale and the other centres that were all built. That was, you know, collaboration with some of the armed forces, and how you were talking about how healthcare can be impacted by a whole host of these. And the other thing that Sean said quite a lot, and we did touch upon in the interview, was about community. So as you said, the defence trainees, that there's not that many of them, but they are spread all around the country, but they're a really tight-knit group. And that's something that really obviously echoes very much within primary care, that whole theme of communities. Like our last episode was all about communities and different sort of people who are representing that. Check out that episode if you haven't listened to it. But a gentle plug there. I really enjoyed it. Sorry, Johannes, what were you saying?
Yeah, no, I was just thinking, you know, we don't maybe get as much exposure to these trainees just because, you know, they tend to be located where the military is located. And as Sean will explain, you know, they have bases elsewhere outside London. So again, it's a nice way to see how trainees are working outside London. And I was just thinking it'd be really interesting if anyone who's listening is a defence trainee from one of the other forces, it would be really interesting to see how training has been for you and how that compares to what Sean's been through in the Navy.
Yeah, I think that would be, I agree, that would be really interesting. And I think, as Johannes says, again, it's, you know, the experience of being a trainee in London is really good, but in some ways it is also a very kind of like sheltered environment because you don't have exposure to very different ways of practicing. The experiences that people like defence trainees can bring, or working in a rural area can bring a host of other opportunities. So it's always really interesting to kind of expand my horizons beyond the M25.
The other thing actually is the other side of the coin is not just the trainees, but actually the patients. So we had a really good workshop as part of the VTS last year on veteran health. And we had a group of veterans who came to our VTS and talked about sort of the health issues that they've had from a mental health and physical health point of view. And then also gave us an idea of sort of how things work in terms of their care, their general practice care. Interestingly, if you're a veteran, when you make a referral to a specialist team, they automatically get priority based on so you have to make that clear on your referral that this patient is a veteran. And obviously there's lots of third sector and voluntary organizations that really support veterans, so being aware of those is really important as a trainee. If you are to see a patient who is was in the armed forces, being aware where to sort of point them to or signpost them to in terms of third sector and voluntary organizations is also very important.
Yeah, and also kind of on the subject of veterans, it is an area that the college does recognise, and on the website, if people want to learn more, they've got a kind of veterans healthcare toolkit, other resources that you can use and have a look at, which could help if you do work in an area that might have a number of veterans that are members of your community as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one question that I have for Johannes before we dive into this interview is, do you think there was anything that you sort of took from your time in the Navy that you carry with you sort of as an ST1 or in your GP training?
I think, like you guys were saying earlier, there are so many, it sounds strange to call them soft skills that you're getting from a military organization. But there are so many leadership skills, and I think just some of those more remote medicine skills that are really useful. I left the military directly before I came to medical school. So I spent a lot of time with Navy doctors and Navy medics. And it's a really fascinating place to work. And I've always thought about going back in. So again, it was really interesting to hear about Sean talking about entry points into that career. And I think, yeah, what he's about to say is quite inspiring, and it will probably tickle a few taste buds out there, get a few GPs considering heading out to sea.
I mean, shall we just lead straight into the interview then?
Yeah, I mean, prepare to have your taste buds tickled, everybody, as we hear from Sean and Mira talking to one another.
So today I'm joined with Sean, who is one of the defence reps based in Portsmouth. And I'm really glad, after what sounds like some grueling nights, has really kindly taken the time to come and chat with me today a little bit about what being a defence rep is and what's going on. But enough from me, I'll hand it over to Sean. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Sean.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Mira. My nights weren't too bad, actually. So my name's Sean, and I'm a GP ST1, currently working in paediatrics at the QA hospital in Portsmouth. I suppose the thing that makes me a bit different is I'm a medical officer in the Royal Navy.
I mean, that's definitely something that's really interesting and something I really want to know a bit more about. So how does one even sort of end up? Is that something you always wanted to do? Did you know you wanted to enter this defence route?
Yeah, so it's kind of a long long story, really. So I grew up
in the time.
So I grew up in South Wales, kind of overlooking the Bristol Channel, right next to the sea. And I joined the Sea Cadets as a young kid, and that really gave me a bit of drive for adventure, a bit of drive to travel and just do something a bit different. And it got me interested in the Navy, and it's a bit cliche, but I did actually want to go and see a bit of the world, and I thought the Navy could give me that opportunity. The kind of problem was that I was also doing okay at school and kind of wanted to do medicine as well, and didn't really think the two things would really line up. But what I found is that there is actually the chance to be a medical officer in the Navy. And for me, that was the perfect kind of match. It was the chance for me to go and do some traveling, to see some of the world, but also to practice medicine in a really kind of unique and, sometimes remote and challenging settings. And it's been fantastic ever since, and I've never looked back.
I mean, it sounds, obviously, you're a great person to talk to about this because you sound so positive and enthusiastic about it. And, you're right. It sounds like it's been a perfect blend of your interests that you found quite, early on your niche of practicing medicine, but in a setting that suits you, which I think probably applies to a lot of people who might be listening, of actually what general practice means to them may not be the same as it does to, the person that they sit next to in a classic weekly VTS or anything like that. So how has the training of, the structure of medical school, naval duties and foundation training, how has all that worked out for you?
Yeah, sure. So I actually joined the Navy officially when I was a medical student.
Okay.
So there's a scholarship scheme. The Army and the Air Force have something very similar. And sort of for the Navy, they take maybe 15 to 20 entrants a year. They support you financially and also educationally through your university years. So I joined in my third year of uni and was then sort of linked with the Navy as a cadet up until the end of university.
Okay.
After that, I then went and did my foundation years, just like everyone else. So we do them in centres which have a bit of a link to the military. So I went to Birmingham.
Right.
I spent my F1 year in the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which was a brand new and shiny hospital at the time. And then my F2 year was in City Hospital, Birmingham, right in the city centre. Because we're military trainees, our foundation programme was focused around specialties that would be useful in a military environment. We have to do emergency medicine and general practice, obviously. But I also got the opportunity to do a few other acute specialties like acute medicine, general surgery, trauma and orthopedics, and just things that are useful or might come in handy when you're kind of out somewhere on your own or in a small team where you need to act acutely.
I mean, that makes perfect sense. And so when you were doing your F1 and F2, did you also have to do additional sort of naval training and other things alongside it as well? Or
so not too much. They kind of leave us alone to concentrate on becoming a doctor, because at that stage you're a bit of a baby and you don't really know what you're doing. So they let you focus on your medical skills with just a soft touch of annually having to do our sort of mandatory training for the armed forces. So we have to stay fit. We have to stay current with our equality and diversity training and just making sure that the military doesn't lose sight of us whilst we're doing our foundation program. But for the most part, during that time, our focus is really getting ready for what's coming next.
And I suppose that makes perfect sense, because you have a very specific role in the future for when you're doing the things you need to be, knowing the medicine and the foundations to be best place where you are. So I guess that probably leads me to, so then, and now you're a GP trainee. So was that always a natural choice for you to enter into that training?
So there's a bit of a gap in the middle between then and now.
Fill me in.
How it gets interesting. So this is the bit that everyone that joins the military gets excited about. So when you join the military, pretty much until the end of F2, everything is kind of the same as a standard NHS trainee. But when you come out of F2, we then go and do what's called our general duties time. And all three services do this. They all do it slightly differently. But for the Navy, I spent 3 years as a doctor at sea and sort of getting that chance to really fulfill my dream, which was going and doing a bit of traveling and seeing a bit of the world and doing that remote medicine that I'd always wanted to do.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. So I'm obviously going to ask you, where did you go, if you can tell me that?
Yeah. Okay. So I was really, really lucky. So after F2, you do a short stint at the Institute of Naval Medicine, where we get some additional training in some of the more specialist areas to be a general duties doctor. So that's things like diving and hyperbaric medicine, some tropical and travel medicine, and then radiation and nuclear medicine for our submarine doctors, and aviation medicine for those that do flying or get involved with the Fleet Air Arm. So I did that training, and then I joined HMS Protector. HMS Protector is a survey ship with a crew of about 120 or so, and I'm the only doctor. I had two fantastic medical assistants who were kind of somewhere between a paramedic and a HCA, and they were there with me, and we went to largely most of the Southern Hemisphere, so the South Atlantic, including South America, South Africa, and then down into the Southern Ocean, which is notorious for being one of the worst seas in the world, but also visiting places like South Georgia, which is an absolutely beautiful uninhabited island in the South Atlantic, which was just amazing.
I mean, I can only imagine the sights that you've seen, and, you know, it sounds like you fulfilled your dream of being able to travel whilst doing what you loved, which is great. But, you know, I have to point out, one doctor for 120, I mean, that sounds, at least, I know lots of people complain of working night shifts and feeling like they're the only doctor covering what feels like endless wards, but in the open seas, that must have felt like such a big responsibility.
It is. As an F, you know, you've only really done your foundation years, so you're still a relatively junior doctor, but it is hugely professionally rewarding. You know, I think of one of my favorite Navy days when we were at anchor off South Georgia, and we had divers in the water where it's maybe -1 or -1 degree centigrade water. We had Royal Marines leading a team of people retracing some of Shackleton's route over South Georgia, doing some mountaineering. And we had a crew on the ship. And you as the doctor are responsible for all these activities that are going on at the same time and trying to think a way out if you start to have problems. Because down there, we could reasonably be 2 weeks away from outside help. So there's a huge amount of responsibility and planning that goes into doing this to make sure that we can do it safely and we get our crew home in one piece and having enjoyed the experience and done what we went there to do.
I mean, and I think, do you know what? I'm a bit speechless, a bit in awe, because I think to me that sounds absolutely terrifying, but that totally makes sense for someone that is ready to take on that challenge, and you've had your training and the skills and you really put to use all the experience you had in foundation training to do all of that. But I can't, your mind must have been in lots of different places all at the same time, I guess, preparing for any eventuality. And how was it? How was life being at sea? How did you find that?
You get used to it. We are remote, but we're very well supported. So there is always somebody on the end of the phone that can help you. Our normal reach back service will go to a GP. Because actually that's the sort of person we usually need, because we need that generalist overview of, you know, a holistic management of a patient most of the time. But then also sometimes we need that specialist input, and we can reach out to defense consultants in, you know, in specialties if we have a specific issue. But in terms of life at sea, the seasickness can be a challenge. Especially down in the Southern Ocean, where there's very few people that don't feel the motion of the ocean. But it, you know, it's the nice thing about it is it really is a sort of camaraderie. There's a very good team ethos on board, and everybody's out to make sure that we get the job done, we do it safely, and, you know, we make sure that we are doing what we're there to do.
I think that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I suppose in a way you could draw that in a parallel to that, to how it work, teams work in hospital and in primary care as well. It's about good communication, I imagine. It's really imperative that people work together seamlessly, but with their own skill set, so that, as you said, get the job done, although in a completely different setting altogether. So you spent 3 years at sea. And then what happened next?
And then I kind of accidentally found myself doing a little bit of something different again. So I got involved in some of the military medical policy. So I went to Lichfield, where the headquarters of Defence Medical Services is, and was involved in looking at some of the medical employment policy for the armed forces, and looking at whether we have the right medical standards for entry, and whether we need to streamline our processes or change our processes to help people to get into the military and be able to stay in for as long as possible. And that was very different and very a very unusual place to find yourself as a relatively junior doctor. I learned a lot, particularly in the field of occupational medicine and medical law. And then from there, I kind of decided to hang on for one extra year and extended my time as a general duties doctor to work as the chief of staff for the Royal Navy Medical Service. So that essentially involved working in the Royal Navy headquarters, making sure that the Royal Navy Medical Service was achieving its aims, and making sure that we stay at the forefront of medical care on our operations at sea, promoting health and well-being within the naval service and looking at strategies to improve that, and then also developing and reviewing our clinical policy to make sure it was fit for the modern Navy and an equal opportunities employer.
I mean, and all of that sounds so fascinating, because I suppose lots of trainees, when they're coming through the route of medical school and then subsequent training, really look to expand in other ways, wherever it may be. But looking at those skills that you've just mentioned, you know, leadership, working in teams, working in governance, working on policy making. And it sounds like this has really sort of given you a broad base of all these sorts of skills that you've sort of been able to hone, which sounds really exciting. I can see how excited you are talking about it, which is it's so great to see, and it's so different from, say, anything I've certainly experienced, and probably people listening as well.
I think that sort of story will hopefully appeal to anybody that's considering general practice, because lots of GPs these days, you know, want to diversify their careers or look at different avenues to take their medical career. And the military has definitely given me that. It's given me the opportunity to practice clinical medicine. I've had some exposure to occupational medicine, policy and medical law. I've done some travel medicine, and, you know, that sort of underpinning of leadership and teamwork all the way through is something that is, you know, I will take forward into my general practice. But, you know, this is a story that I hope that appeals to lots of people that do GP, because we like to be generalist and we like to do, you know, have a varied career. And that's definitely something the Navy's offered me.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised, Sean, if after listening to this, lots of people fancy doing a bit more research into all of this, because it sounds fascinating. And I think a few people probably will listen and think, oh, this might be for me. So I guess a question for me before we sort of hear about the next steps of your journey is, would that entry into the, you know, any of the forces, is that something you could do at stages through your career? It doesn't have to be at university.
Yeah, that's true. So so for the recruitment side of things, we are always recruiting, including right now in the current COVID climate. Mm-hmm. The way the medical recruitment works is that we try to take the majority of our entrants at university.
Yeah.
But then we do also have opportunities to enter at Foundation, and also once people have completed their training.
Okay.
We tend not to take trainees in the middle, but we do take people once they CCT.
And I guess that's really valuable information to know, because if people, if that's something someone has always wanted to look into, they know actually if they are about to CCT or that's something in the future, they can probably find out more information about that.
Yeah, definitely. So if people are interested or want more information, each service, so the Navy, the Army and the Air Force have their own recruitment services. And if you just go directly to the service you're interested in, either to one of their recruitment centers or via their website, they can then direct you to the specialist medical recruiters who can advise on the sort of on the specific policy, depending on where you are in your training, what specialty you intend to do, and, you know, can talk them through the process.
Thanks, Sean. I think that's really helpful information. I guess jumping back, in a sense, so you did all of this amazing work a few years down the line from, say, graduating, and you're at this point. At what happened next?
So I am now back in training. So after spending my time at sea and traveling and, you know, doing all the stuff that I wanted to do, I am now back to do my general practice training. So I am still in the Navy, but I'm now embedded within the NHS. We do the same GP training scheme as everyone else. So we have the same list of criteria and exams, and we still have to meet the same benchmarks to get our MRC GP. The placements that we do are pretty much identical to what NHS trainees will do. And then at the end of it, I will go back to delivering primary care within the armed forces. So the armed forces deliver their own primary care. So all of our military personnel have access to primary care within the forces, and that's provided by Defence Medical Services. So when I finish my general practice training, I'll then go back and deliver primary care for our soldiers, sailors and airmen across defence. I'm hoping to also get some additional training. I would like to do my diploma in aviation medicine, just so that I've got a little bit of a better grounding in that particular area, because depending on how much you know about the Navy, we have just had two brand new aircraft carriers and a lot of brand new F-35 aircraft. So the future for the Navy is looking very interesting. It's the first time, or this is our return to having a proper carrier strike group. So that's having aircraft on an aircraft carrier supported by frigates, destroyers and submarines so that we can send a full fleet to sea. That's very exciting from our side of things. And I would love to be one of the doctors that supports that. And being one of the doctors on board one of the aircraft carriers is a real dream.
I mean, Sean, from hearing everything you've told me so far, I have no doubt that's probably where you will end up. And to me, it sounds like something out of a Marvel movie of all of these things that you've mentioned. But that's because I have a woeful understanding of all this. But this has been honestly so fascinating to hear about. And so I guess now you started your GP training in August, if I'm right. And how was that transition? I mean, I appreciate it's obviously some time between being at sea, doing more policy work and other things, and then now going back into sort of the world of medicine and work with all the other trainees. How has that transition been for you?
Yeah, that you've really picked up on quite an interesting point. It is, I was quite worried about that. I think it's fair to say. It's quite a big step to go back into hospital medicine. You know, I had been out of hospital medicine for, you know, nearly 5 years by the time I went back. So it took me a little bit of a while to get my feet back on the ground and get used to working in a hospital environment again with a slightly different team, you know, and working with, you know, the rotors and getting back used to managing your time effectively and managing a new portfolio. But the defense trainees have a very supportive defense deanery. So our deanery is very good, and they make sure that, you know, that transition is as smooth as possible. and that we know what's expected of us to get through our GP training. They also provide some bespoke sort of courses, and we use some of our study leave to do our Highlands and Islands courses, we call them. And those are sort of bespoke weeks away where we get a little bit of additional general practice training with a military slant, just to get us prepared for thinking in that way of operating as a GP in the military once we get to our CCT.
That all of that sounds so well, like it's been so well thought out, and there's clearly a very great support structure around you and layers of support around that, with obviously your deanery and how it all works. I guess from a point of interest for myself, so say as a GPST1, how would you know numbers in terms of other defence trainees who are sort of doing the same things as you are? Or is that something that's really difficult to...
So we are spread out all over the place. So we tend to go... So the GP trainees will go to a variety of hospitals that have military associations. I'm in Portsmouth, but there are, for the Navy at least, there are placements in Portsmouth, Plymouth, Birmingham, Northallerton. So we are disparate and we are spread out. But one of the nice things about the deanery is that tends to bring us together. So our Highlands and Islands courses are great opportunities to bring all the trainees back to the same place again. And you meet friends that you may not have seen for the whole year. Just to recap and see where everyone's ended up and what we're all doing, and that's just we are a remote deanery, and we are very spread out across the country, but actually we're a tight-knit group and everybody knows everybody quite well, and you know, those opportunities to come back together and meet and do some study together and learn together are invaluable for us, just to keep that military ethos. Because we know that as soon as we CCT, we will be going back to our respective services and delivering for defence again. So it's just remembering that, you know, whilst we go through this process, we are still military, even though we might be working in paediatrics, wearing scrubs and just blending in with everyone else.
Well, I think it's that, isn't it? It's the skill that you have to assimilate to doing the training, like every other trainee, maintaining all those competencies, achieving, you know, the exams, as well as doing this. And you have to have a real passion to be able to sort of manage all of that, as well as, I'm sure, your social, personal lives and everything else. But I think the thing that's really nice that's echoed through all of that is that sense of community that you describe, which I think lots of people who do go into primary care kind of have that urge, don't they, for a sense of community, whether it's serving their local one, obviously the defence community and communities wider than that. So that's a really nice sort of journey that you've told us there, Sean. I think I probably couldn't have a chat with you without sort of talking about, what job is it that you're working on at the moment?
So I'm currently doing paediatrics.
You're on paediatrics, fine. And obviously, as I say, you can't go without mentioning the big C word, which would all be, of course, COVID-19. Yeah. How has that sort of impacted in terms of your general day-to-day, would you say?
So for me personally, COVID hasn't changed my role too much. So I've been lucky. I've managed to continue with my GP training. You know, we've got a very supportive department. And because of the way COVID seems to affect children, our workload has actually been fairly stable. We don't seem to see children severely affected by COVID. The ones that we have seen have largely been incidental, positive results. We are remaining vigilant for Kawasaki-like syndrome. We haven't had any cases in QA at the moment, but we are just staying vigilant for that. But broadly, paediatrics has remained unaffected aside from the sort of elective work and surgical work that has obviously had to be put on hold at the moment. From a wider defence point of view, defence has very much been supporting the NHS and the government in, you know, what has been a really unprecedented time. Many of our staff are already or were already working in hospitals around the country at all levels of clinical care. And they continue to do so, whilst other branches of defence have been redeployed as medical planners or aiding in the logistical supply chain of the NHS, and also more recently, some of the mobile testing centres that you see as well.
And I think that, you know, that's another great example of how it's not just core medical professionals that have had to go through lots of different changes. So you touched upon redeployment of, you know, offering other services as well. It's clearly been a big impact for lots of people, and including, you know, the wider public who may have been used to a commute and traveling into work and now are completely shifting their lives as to what's going on. So it's been a really interesting time for a lot of people. It will be intriguing to see how things go forward, I guess. But you seem pretty clear and set onto what your future goals are going to be, Sean.
Yeah, I think I know where I'm going. All of our military trainees are very well supported, and we're going, you know, we're all trying to continue with our training as best as possible and get to the other end and, you know, achieve this MRCGP that we're all aiming for. Being part of the AIT community has been, a really good opportunity to feed into some of the really good work that's gone on with generating alternative options for the CSA exams, and looking at how we can run the AKT, in a socially distanced world, and having that opportunity as a defence trainee to sit on that committee has been very helpful, just so that we can have that two-way dialogue about, you know, what's helpful for defence, and also to feed back to defence what's, you know, the way it's going to develop and what the possibilities might be going forward. So, having that link into the Royal College Trainee Committee has been invaluable. That's something I've really enjoyed doing.
And, you know, I definitely can speak for myself, and I definitely know about that my colleagues on the podcast will be, that it's been great to have such a wide and diverse AIT committee with regards to geographically where people are coming from, but also stages of training and whatever they may be interested in, and bringing all of that to the fore. So earlier in the year when coronavirus wasn't sort of in the situation where we are now, we all had our initial meeting, and there were so many great ideas being discussed with everybody across tables, and that was really fascinating. And I think the committee's aim with RCGP is obviously for us all to move forward together and try and still work on the things that really mean something to trainees and GPs for the future, so that we can work on those aims to get really positive outcomes. And I think defence really contributes to that as well. And I have to say, I've met Sean, once in person, and then after that, you know, via the magic that is Zoom on our multiple AIT chats. But actually, I really want to thank you, and I'm very grateful that you managed to carve this time after nights to talk to me today, because I feel like I know a lot more about you now, Sean, but also it'd be really interesting to catch up in the future as well and see where things are at. But were there any other last words you wanted to sort of say before we round things off?
Thank you very much. It's been really good actually to have the opportunity just to talk a little bit about what I love and, you know, what I've spent my time doing. I suppose my parting message would be that just for people to be aware, really, that defence trainees are out there, and we do spend the majority of our time embedded in the NHS. And a lot of the time that goes unnoticed because we're in scrubs or we're out of uniform or we're working in departments where maybe it wouldn't be, people might not think it would be, you know, it'd be unusual to find a defence trainee. But come and talk to us. We're not scary. And, we are doing our best to make sure that, you know, we support the NHS through what is clearly a really, really difficult time, and come out of this all the better.
I mean, a very important take-home message. And yeah, absolutely. Talk to your colleagues. Find out a little bit more about them. Your day may change completely, like mine has today. Thanks a lot, Sean.
That's all right, Mira. You're very welcome.
Great. Well, that was, as expected, a really great interview, and definitely gave me loads of information. And as Johannes said, it was quite like an inspiring conversation to hear, to make me think quite differently around what it's like to be a defence trainee in the Navy. I really enjoyed it. Thanks, Mira, for doing that with Sean. And thank you, Sean, for taking part as well.
Absolutely. Thanks again to Sean.
So I think that's everything for this week's episode. As we say, we'd really like to focus a lot more on other types of trainees. So if you're a member of a different armed force, if you are a trainee that works in a really rural area. We're really keen to try and diversify the voices that we hear from on this podcast as much as possible. So you can always get in touch with us via email or on Twitter. All of the details are shared in the description for the podcast. And yeah, for today's end of the show, we are going to be playing out with another performance from an NHS choir. This time it's the NHS choir, who are based in Lewisham and Greenwich, and they have again been rehearsing remotely over Zoom during the pandemic. And today they are going to be playing us out with I Can See Clearly Now. So as we play that out, I look forward to speaking to Johannes, Mira, Hatim next time. And thanks again to everybody for listening. Take care, guys.
A plate full of bread and cheese and then a power nap and woke up like 2 seconds before we were recording, which is why I was just speaking absolute nonsense for some of that, but I'm almost awake now, so